I'm Carrie Miller, now in depth on the narcissists that we know and love.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
But I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
I think anyone who's ever been or run for president wouldn't deny that it takes a pretty healthy ego. After all, you're saying that you have the right stuff to manage an extraordinary amount of power. But when is it ego and when is it narcissism? And really, what's the difference? Jeffrey Kluger writes in his new book, it takes more than mere neediness and charisma to be a true narcissist, and it takes more than mere narcissism to make it to the White House. Mr. Kluger examines narcissists in their natural habitats, politics, corner offices, relationships. And he concludes, we are more and more living in a mirror world, with the most prominent sight being the reflected one. And too many of us like that view just fine. As Jeffrey Kluger joins me, I want to hear your experience with this. Do you have a narcissist in your life, a friend, partner, coworker? Does their narcissism both attract and frustrate you? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We're on the Daily Circuit page. I'm on Twitter. Jeff Kluger's new book is called The Narcissist Next Door, and he joins us this morning from L.A. Jeff, welcome back to the show. I remember our conversation about siblings. I'm so happy to have you back.
I'm so happy to be back. That was a lot of fun talking about that book. And this book, I get to be a little snarkier. So that was fun to write.
You are. I phrased that question to our audience about attracting and frustrating because you point out in the book, narcissists are often, they're sparkling personalities and they're a lot of fun to be around. We like narcissists quite often, don't we?
Well, absolutely. And that's one of the problems. You know, narcissism, falling for a narcissist is a little like falling for a drug. If you didn't like the experience the very first time you did it, you would never go back. Narcissists are very often the most charismatic person in the room, the funniest person in the room, the most engaged and energetic person in the room. They do a very, very good job of impersonating sort of interest and engagement with the people around them. So not only are you in the presence of somebody who's smart and funny and charismatic, you're also in the presence of somebody who seems very much to be listening to you and engaged with you. Now, typically they aren't. And in fact, when you ask somebody at the end of an evening, yeah, you say this person was listening to you, but did you speak at all? And the non-narcissist will say, well, come to think of it, no, I said almost nothing.
I do like how you talk about the impersonation because apparently that is easier to do than I thought it was. I feel like I would be on the lookout. I'd be skeptical about narcissists, but I'll bet that I've been charmed by them as much as anybody else has.
Oh, yeah. And we all think we're skeptical about them. We all think, oh, I could never fall for a three-card Monty dealer. I could never fall for somebody who is selling me a bad stock. But that's because we flatter ourselves that we're more acutely aware of things than other people are. It's an ordinary bias. It's a little vain, but it's a very common bias. But narcissists are very, very good at being seductive and being cleverly seductive. It is, as you point out, why so many of them make it to the White House. And it's the reason, frankly, that some of them fail. One of the reasons John Edwards failed, aside from the fact that he's simply self-destructive and destructed in one of the most repellent public displays in modern American politics, was because there was just too much preening. There was just too much vanity. People, even when they liked him, felt a little skeeved by him, as if they were somehow being sold a bill of goods. Bill Clinton, by contrast, we knew Clinton was a charmer. We knew that Clinton was seductive, but he was so, and still is, so good at it that we just think, all right, seduce me. I don't care.
I surrender to that, right?
I surrender.
This story that you tell about Clinton, Jeff, when you had just published your first book, Apollo 13, is really interesting. Can I ask you to tell that again, what happens with Clinton?
Sure, good. Absolutely. And it was really a two-part story. We were in the Oval Office when Jim Lovell, the commander of Apollo 13 and my collaborator on the book, was being given the Space Medal of Honor. And the first thing I noticed about Clinton was at the end of the ceremony, he came down a small line of people. I was the last person in the line. And he was, saying hello. And I scanned down the line and realized I was the only person in that line he hadn't met yet. So I figured I better introduce myself. And he got to me. And no sooner had I begun to get my name out and explain why I was there than he waved me off and said, I know who you are. And I thought, this is amazing. Of course he knows who I am. I'm the most important person in the room. Now, I was aware of the fact that that was that Clintonian ability to make you feel that way. But something else a minute later was a little more personal to the experience. I was standing in the middle of the Oval Office rug. Off to my right was Jim Lovell and Bill Clinton. And, you know, Lovell is Naval Academy grad, American hero, married to the same woman his entire life. And Clinton is cut from a somewhat different cloth. And there were a group of other people talking on the other side, including Tom Hanks, who played Jim in the movie, and Pete Conrad, the third man on the moon. And I knew that I really should join that conversational cluster off on the other side. But I was so intrigued by watching the Lovell-Clinton dynamic because, you know, they were two very different men, and yet Clinton was Lovell's commander-in-chief who had finally given him this award that he deserved, and I just wanted to stand there and watch. Well, Clinton spied me from the corner of his eye and realized that I looked like the sort of lost person at a party, and without taking his eyes off Lovell, kind of tapped him on the elbow, stepped three steps closer to me, and gathered me into their conversation. Yeah. Now, I've done that for people at parties a million times, and people have done that for me at parties a million times. We've all done that. But this was the president doing that for me. And he had me for life at that point. And that was pre-Lewinsky. When Lewinsky came along, I said, I don't care. I would vote for this guy for an 11th term.
You know what they used to say about Clinton was that when he'd come into a room, he would quickly sense the one person in the room who wasn't won over. And he would spend an awful lot of time trying to win that person over. Quite opposite to what they say about Obama. Is that kind of the nature, the essential nature of the narcissist, to want everyone's admiration?
It's an excellent question, and it depends on the type of narcissism. You're absolutely right about Clinton, which is why he used to drive his handlers crazy because, 10 minutes at a rope line would always turn to half an hour at a rope line because every hand he shook was like a little kiss, and every metaphorical kiss he got was one more validation that somebody liked him. I asked Joe Klein at Time Magazine once, and I cite this in the book, we were asking him why Clinton continues to work so hard years after the White House. And I said, Joe, what is Clinton's long game? And he said, Clinton's long game is the same thing it's always been, which is to be loved by every one of the 7 billion people on the planet. Now, in the case of Clinton, this probably comes from what's called the mask model of narcissism, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's narcissism that's a clever and often somewhat brittle masquerade to cover up what may be its exact opposite, a well of low self-esteem and in many cases, though probably not Clinton's, even deep self-loathing. Look, Clinton is the first to describe himself. When he talks about himself in his autobiography, he says that he grew up in high school as the fat kid from band. Mm. And when you look at him in his band uniform, he is a chubby, goofy, nerdy-looking guy, the last person in the world you think would have a bit of charisma. He grew up in a household in which he never knew his mother. His stepfather was an alcoholic. They were, by no means a wealthy family. This wasn't, the Kennedys and the Bushes and the Roosevelts. This was a completely different quality of person. So for him, there's a lot of overcompensation involved. Another kind of narcissist, George W. Bush, is very different. There was a certain arrogance to Bush. I remember that moment when Bush, at the end of his first term, he was asked by a White House correspondent,
yes,
it happened, a Time Magazine correspondent, can you think of a single mistake you've made in your first term? And he drew a blank. Well, who among us couldn't think of a mistake we made in our last 4 years on the job? And none of us launched a war in Iraq that was already going badly. In his case, though, He grew up with the idea that I am a princeling. I am above the rules. I can do better than other people because I am better than other people. And, you know, you saw this in his upbringing. He went into the oil business. He did not do well, but he came out having made money. He invested a little tiny bit of money in the Texas Rangers. Other people invested much more, and yet he walked away with $14 million. He ran for president and lost. He lost the popular vote, and yet 2 months later, he's standing with his hand on one hand in the air and the other hand on the Bible. So he came through life with the exact opposite feeling. There's something dew-kissed about me, and I am therefore better than other people.
Jeff Kluger with us. You hear us talking about narcissism, and I'm asking you this morning, if you have a narcissist in your life, is it a friend? Maybe you're married to one, in a relationship with one. Maybe it's a coworker. Does their narcissism both attract and frustrate you? Because you've heard what Jeff has been saying about the charisma, the attention, the way we are just kind of magnetically pulled into their orbits. Do you experience that? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Steph, it looks like we've gotten a good react. I'm getting a lot on Twitter here.
I am,
and
too.
Off the Daily Circuit page. What are you hearing?
Rick says, I have a very narcissistic friend. He's a great guy, but he thinks that he knows all the solution to every one of life's problems. I'm commonly his bad example. He seems to think he can fix me, even though he's only 2 years older than me. I joke that my phone conversations with him are 20 minutes of me going, yeah, or uh-huh, or yep. I can barely get a word in edgewise.
To the phones to Robin in Pine City. Hey, Robin, thanks for waiting.
No problem. I mean, who wouldn't want to wait?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Well, I'm calling because, you know, one of my fears, and knows why, is that I'm actually narcissistic, or that I'm, you know, that person that everyone talks about as soon as they leave the room going, oh, you know? I'm very charismatic. I'm very opinionated, and people do seem drawn to me. But I wonder about the definition of narcissism, you know, that you're using. You know?
Good, yeah. But Robin, you're here to say you think you're a narcissist. Is that right?
I do, but I don't think I'm inherently evil. I don't think I'm without consideration.
Okay. Hey, your phone's cutting in and out, but I think we know what you... How unusual, Jeffrey, is it that somebody would say, yeah, I'm a narcissist, cop to it?
Well, there are two answers to that. And one of the answers, funnily enough, and this came out, it was a study that came out right after I finished my book, that showed that one of the best ways to determine if somebody is a narcissist, it's really a very complex process of asking the question, are you a narcissist? And they will often say yes.
Really?
Now, in the case of a narcissist, it's often because what they're saying is, well, yeah, you know, if you mean do I have a high opinion of myself, I do. But that's because, gosh, I'm the best person I know. I deserve to have a high opinion of myself. Now, the thing is, though, different from your caller, you know, there is what I call capital N narcissism, which is clinical narcissistic personality disorder, and it afflicts only about 1-3% of the population. But you move down the spectrum and you have lowercase n narcissism. And in these cases, they can be people who are nearly as bad as the full-blown narcissist and often will come to ruin the way narcissists do. Or you move a little further down and it's just somebody with a healthy, robust sense of confidence and charm and intelligence and, you know, someone who goes out into the world and thinks, well, you know, I mean, I think I've got a good personality, and, you know, my life tends to confirm that. So you move down, and ultimately you get down to people with low self-esteem. But the difference is, and this is different from your caller, true narcissism is what's generally called an egocentric disorder. In other words, the person is impenetrable. The person does not realize there's a problem.
Uh-huh.
It's very much like paranoid personality disorder. I'm not paranoid. People really are after me. It's like histrionic personality disorder. I'm not overreacting. There really is a reason to be hysterical. In the case of narcissism, it really is a sense of I am not a narcissist. It's just that the people around me are dullards and incompetents, and I need to sort of be in charge of whatever is going on in the room. This is very different from anxiety disorders like, say, obsessive compulsive disorder or phobias. In those cases, people know their behavior is just nuts and they deeply want to stop it. They just can't stop it. So they will go into a therapist's office and say, help me fix this. This is a terrible problem. I want to get rid of it. That's called an ego dystonic disorder.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons it's easy to get a person with an anxiety disorder into therapy and very hard to get a person with a personality disorder into therapy.
And while we're talking about the context of this, for anybody who's interested in kind of the Greek root of this, that it comes from the myth of Narcissus, and mythology says that Narcissus was a beautiful young man. He was destined for a long life if he never gazed upon his own reflection. I was reading the Encyclopedia Britannica online. It says that he was so heartbroken over the loss of his twin sister that he gazed into a spring of water to recall her features. And maybe he's gotten a bit of a bad rap, Jeff.
Well, that's interesting because people, I recently heard that part of it also.
Mm-hmm.
And the story that we typically hear is that he was gazing into a pool of water to admire himself,
right, yeah,
and fell in and drowned. But yes, I heard the other part, and then I heard somebody, you know, then run way too far with the other thing and say, and this is, you know, really just a, it's a parable for psychosexual development, and he had lost the feminine side of himself, and on. And I thought, this is, you know, this is just a college grant that was written by someone with a little too much time on his hand. There is something to be said for the idea that, you know, that whatever Narcissus was doing or whatever his motivations were, you know, there is a whole lot of time narcissists spend metaphorically gazing at themselves.
On Twitter, from someone who says, anonymous, please, I grew up with a narcissist mom. It was so toxic, I had to cut ties. If it wasn't about her, it just didn't matter. And to the phones here, I think, on another parent narcissist, to Brian in Minneapolis. Is that your experience, Brian, a parent?
Absolutely. My father is the most narcissistic person I've ever met in my life. And as time went on, from the time I was about 18, I started recognizing it. And it just, if it wasn't about him, and how people were always screwing him, and it was just everything was him-centric, no matter what the conversation, and even with his, you know, dealing with his grandchildren and stuff. And I literally just cut ties, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, and just do not deal with him anymore because it's just impossibility. And there's been no change literally throughout my entire life.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that is, I'm sorry.
Jeff, I was just going to say, I can't imagine that narcissists make very good parents. Does the research bear that out?
It does bear that out. And one of the reasons is that, I mean, you talk to any parent and they will tell you that the first thing that overcomes you when you become a parent is a profound selflessness. You know, I mean, you hear parents will always say, you know, in their prayers will be, you know, put me between harm and my child. If a car is coming, let me get hit by it. If a disease is coming, give it to me. It's one of the sine qua nons. It's sort of the table stakes of being a good parent. If you don't have that, if you don't have that sense that in some respects, nature is done with me now because I have reproduced and my job is simply to get this younger version of me into adulthood, safely launched where he and she can then go on to reproduce. If you don't have that sense of what your role is in nature, you can't be a good parent. And what your caller just described is another very big part of narcissism. It's not just the grandiosity and self-absorption and belief that all things can somehow be made about the narcissist. It's also the sense of grievance that often results from that. So, you know, if a bad thing happened, it somehow is about me. If a bad thing happened, it somehow is done malevolently to hurt me. I had a wonderful experience with, at least I was self-aware enough about it, which is, you know, sort of a funny story, but also quite telling. A number of years ago, early in my time working at Time magazine, there was a story that came out on a Wednesday that NASA had spotted an asteroid and that it was potentially on a target to collide with Earth in 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, raised all kinds of big questions about the menace from space because space rocks are real. It raised all kinds of big questions about how we defend ourselves, about our existential place in the universe, and on and on and on. And, you know, I worked then and continue to in the science section. And this was a Wednesday. These were on the days when we closed the magazine on a Friday. Wednesday, which meant that when you start up a big fat cover story on a Wednesday, you are in for two very long nights. We would often stay there till 3 and 4 in the morning. So we all gathered to talk about this story. And the first thing I thought was, oh, man, why does this have to happen on a Wednesday? And then I stopped myself and thought, okay, it's the end of the world, and I've made it my drama. Now, happily, just the coda, the next day NASA admitted that it got its numbers wrong and we were safe, so we didn't have to do the story. But it at least I was able to say, maybe there's something larger at stake here than how I spend the next 48 hours.
Jeff, every journalist has had that experience. I'm telling you, I have too, and I'm just smart enough not to tell the story about myself. Jeff Kluger is with us. We're talking about his new book, The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. I'm asking you if you know and love a narcissist, if you were raised by a narcissist, work with a narcissist, what's the experience like? What have you learned about that? Get to us online, nprnews.org. Talk to us about it on Twitter. It's at @CarrieNPR. Or 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Hey, we'll get right back to your calls and questions on the other side of news. Phil, what's your top story?
Hi, Carrie. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has visited his country's National War Memorial in Ottawa. That's where a soldier was killed yesterday by a gunman who then stormed nearby Parliament. Officials say the attacker was shot and killed there by the legislature's sergeant-at-arms. Harper laid a wreath at the war memorial this morning. The Treasury Department says Islamic State militants are earning about $1 million a month from black market oil sales. The official who leads the department's effort to undermine the group's financial strength says the militants have also taken in at least $20 million in ransom payments this year from kidnappings. He says the group also gets several $1 million a month from wealthy donors and from extortion rackets and other criminal activities. The hospital where a man diagnosed with Ebola died and two nurses were infected with the virus says its revenues and patient rolls have plummeted. Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas says its revenue fell 25% in the first 20 days of October, shortly after Thomas Duncan was admitted with Ebola. The hospital says emergency room visits have fallen more than 50%. An already upbeat mood on Wall Street today may be getting even brighter. A measurement designed to predict the economy's future health posted a solid increase in September after showing no gain in August. The Conference Board says its index of leading indicators rose 0.8 of a point. Stocks have been higher since the opening bell, with the Dow up right now at 247 points. Investors are encouraged by positive earnings reports from GM, Caterpillar, and other companies. More ahead on the Daily Circuit.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
Who do you see as Target's main competitors this holiday season?
Well, that depends who they decide they want to be. They certainly don't want to be...
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up next hour on the Daily Circuit, it's one of Minnesota's best-known unsolved kidnappings. When Virginia Piper was taken in 1972... Writer Bill Swanson has a new book chronicling the ordeal. We'll talk to him at 11.
Support for this program comes from Stratus Health, a nonprofit healthcare quality improvement organization recognizing National Healthcare Quality Week and the people working to improve healthcare and patient safety. StratusHealth.org. Stratus Health. We make lives better.
Programming is supported by the University of St. Thomas, committed to finding opportunities to boldly answer the call of the 21st century. Online at stthomas.edu. The University of St. Thomas. Challenge yourself. Change our world.
Today's programming is sponsored in part by Rhoda and Don Maines, in memory of Daisy and Alex Maines.
I'm Carrie Miller. We're back to our conversation. And Jeff, I have to tell you, what Steph Curtis and I were talking about off air was sympathizing with people who are raised by narcissist parents. And we kind of asked, are narcissists ever fully satisfied with the attention they're getting? I mean, aren't they kind of born to be dissatisfied, too? Because it's never enough.
Well, yes. The short answer to that is yes. The long answer is that it often depends on the narcissist. First of all, the idea of being born to be a narcissist, there is a very big genetic component to it. It's considered about 77% heritable, according to some twin studies. One study put it a little lower at 64%, but it's in that range. Now, the important thing to remember is that if you have that genetic history, that does not mean you have a 77% chance of being a narcissist. It just means that you have a higher susceptibility to the condition. A lot depends on what your life experience is. But whether narcissists are ever satisfied depends largely on the degree of narcissism, how severe the narcissism is. You know, there are some people, Clinton, again, is a good example. Clinton lived a life, an adult life, in the spotlight. He lived a life of adulation. He's lived a life of being the person who was always the focus of every conversation in every room. And after his presidency, he has proceeded quite hungrily to continue to work that way and probably will until his very last day on earth. Gerald Ford, as somebody once said, treated himself to a retirement that was more suited to Bob Hope, early suppers and all day on the golf course. Well, you know, good for him. I mean, he served his country, and he served his country heroically in a very critical two and a half year period post-Watergate. But he could not have been president in the first place if he hadn't been a narcissist. So, you know, the idea that some narcissists do finally just get full and the other kinds of narcissists are forever at the all-you-can-eat buffet of self-validation.
Steph, off the Daily Circuit page.
Jamie says, isn't narcissism just another human trait? Society needs narcissism just as much as it needs altruism or any other human trait. I don't understand why I have to single out some traits and condemn them as if they are less worthy than others.
That's a great, great point. And if that is what I've conveyed by this conversation so far, I have not then done a very good job of conveying the value of narcissism. And I stress this quite a bit in the book. We need a healthy dose of narcissism. We need a healthy dose of narcissism because unless you believe, you know what, I have this wild idea that I'm going to invent something called the personal computer and change the world with it. And by the way, lots of people may have had that idea, but I, Steve Jobs, am the man who can do it. If he didn't have that cockiness, if he didn't have that arrogance, then the iPad in my suitcase and the iPhone in my pocket and the iMac to my left wouldn't be with me because he's the one who said he could do that. Similarly, whatever else you may say about Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, you know, and people who we see as profoundly selfless, profoundly pious people, if you don't believe they got a charge out of standing up on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial or standing in front of a crowd of a million people and moving an entire nation with the sound of their voice, then you don't know human nature. Now, that is narcissism. That is that feeling felt delicious to them as it would to any other person with a healthy ego. But they were smart, wise, self-aware people who also knew how to keep that in its box. But if they hadn't been energized by narcissism, they wouldn't have done it in the first place. And this is true in the workplace, too. The narcissist who's obnoxious, the narcissist who never listens to anyone else's ideas or doesn't seem terribly interested in anyone else's career advancement but his or her own, is also the person who has the energy and the motivation to be the most creative at a meeting, to speak up the most at meeting, to have the most ideas at meetings. And it may be because he just wants the reinforcement of applause for coming up with yet another good idea. But the point is, the company just benefited from yet another good idea. So narcissism can be a very good, very powerful, very bracing thing. The question is when it becomes the only thing.
Maggie tweeted here. She says, I just texted my narcissistic friend. Are you listening to NPR right now? She better get the hint. To the phones to Victor in St. Paul. Victor, thank you so much for waiting. What's your experience with this?
Well, my experience with narcissism had to do with a guru who I've left 30 years ago, but who I heard died just yesterday. So the question of how this leaves me now is kind of on my plate right now. And I would say there's a great deal of ambivalence because I'm going to be asked to talk about it, and I figured I'd just talk about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a man who sexually abused me, who spent 10 years of my life manipulating, controlling, and keeping me in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
And he is still the guru for people like Arianna Huffington, who, mm-hmm. as world reporter, you'd think would have some inquiry as to this person's characterological disposition. But she continues to keep her head in the sand, or does not at least handle the objective facts of what this man's history was before the public. And it concerns me that she is an arbiter of world thought.
Victor, does it? I was just going
to
ask you, because we have so many other people that want to get in here, but can I ask you this? Have you thought about how it is that narcissists may often end up in these highly influential positions, right? As heads of movements or cults or organizations like the one you were in.
I would say that one of the goals of this narcissist,
mm-hmm.
and I would say most cult leaders, including Scientology leaders and things like that,
mm-hmm.
is that they would like to control as many people as they can without those people's awareness of being controlled.
Jeff?
That, to me, is my learning after all these years.
Jeff, do you think that's right?
I do. Religious leaders, spiritual leaders as narcissists can be a very tricky thing because there is a sometimes blurry line between a true spiritual leader, a true leader of people. You know, Pope Francis right now is a wildly popular pope, and you don't have to be Catholic to think, boy, if there's anyone who's going to be leading, you know, the billion-some Catholics in the world, this is the guy to do it. But other malevolent religious or spiritual leaders are another whole category. Now, in this case, one of the things that's going on with narcissists, and this is a critical feature of narcissism, particularly malignant narcissism, is an utter lack of empathy. The sense that I am controlling this person and I am collecting these people and these people's lives, their needs, their feelings, their welfare is immaterial for me because I am accumulating the largest population of followers I possibly can. You know, I've often thought of people like Kim Jong-un or the entire Kim dynasty in North Korea and think, what is the point of all this anyway? They have all the goodies they want. They have all the riches they want. They could get out of Dodge if they wanted and take billions of dollars with them just to open up their country. What is in it for them in maintaining what's essentially a gulag state of millions of people? They can be getting nothing out of it. But what they are getting out of it is the validation, the gratification, and the intoxication of saying, millions of people are my chattel. Millions of people are in my control, and this it enlarges me. And if my population of 4 million becomes a population of 5 million, the enormity of me was just increased
by
25%.
Jeff, in that example, so the narcissist who heads North Korea would never let themselves even think about the way that fear drives all of this allegiance that they see in the country, right? They would never think these people only obey because they're afraid for their lives. They don't let themselves think that.
That's actually a good point. And I think they are capable, on the one hand, of a certain duality. On the one hand, they know what it takes to control people. He's aware of his prison camps. He's aware of his labor camps. He's aware that if he doesn't keep people ignorant and doesn't keep people in terror, they're ultimately going to rise up. But at the same time, I'm sure he is capable of doublethink, of walking around the country and seeing his picture and the picture of his father in every living room, every public building, every private or every office building in the world or in his country, and isn't necessarily immune to the cult of personality that his people are living. He has to at some point feel, yes, this is me. I am larger than life. I am a larger thing than just an ordinary person. Simply look around yourself and you will see the grandeur that is me.
To the phones to Heidi in St. Cloud. Hey, Heidi.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Well, I've had a lifetime of having two narcissistic parents. I am a little curious if narcissists tend to marry each other, but I have to say that having narcissistic parents it's really made an inroad in the relationship between my sister and I, because we were 5 years apart. And since they were so into their own lives, both of us thought that each of us was getting all of their attention when neither of us got their attention. And so it's been really hurtful, 12 years of therapy. And I'm so glad that you're talking about this topic, because anyways, I've had to think about it.
It's a good question, though, whether narcissists are attracted. I thought narcissists always want someone else who will be forever in their shadow, not another narcissist. Steph, you've got a question about that?
Yeah, I actually have a comment from someone going by Central Minnesota. It says, I know a family comprised of mostly narcissists, and I noticed that the non-narcissists are married to narcissists and vice versa.
Okay.
So this is someone who's noticed that people are pairing up with people who could stare in their glory.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. I mean, first of all, to the question of do narcissists marry each other, I deal with this actually in the book and asked a number of researchers about it. And there's surprisingly little empirical study on it. But what has been done suggests that the quick answer is no, because narcissists are, it's like two positive or two negative magnets. They will repel each other for the simple reason that a narcissist needs somebody who is willing to be the receptacle for the talk, the receptacle for the performances, the receptacle for the vanity and the need for gratification. And the non-narcissist has to be somebody who's either, unfortunately, in some cases, just someone with low self-esteem who doesn't think they deserve any better, or somebody who is so self-contained and centered and grounded that they can say, look, you know, I know who I'm married to, but this person also has a lot of wonderful qualities. And if he or she needs constant care and feeding and ego stroking, I'm willing to do it because it's not really hurting me all that much. When you do get two narcissists together, and it does happen on occasion, it often is for a vain reason as well. Narcissists tend to be are very often the best looking people in any room, and that's not because they just all happen to be handsome or beautiful. It's because they do the most. They care so much about what they're presenting that they present themselves. They turn themselves out in as beautiful a way as possible, and they carry themselves with great confidence, which is often very attractive. So in some cases, two narcissists will be drawn to each other because the narcissistic pair is so much more dazzling than the individual. Mm-hmm. You know, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were both stars of a certain wattage, but they achieved a certain nuclear fission when they became Brangelina because they're both stunning and they're both extraordinarily charismatic. I'm not necessarily saying they're narcissistic, but they both, in terms of the impact they have on people just by walking in the room, they have a sort of tectonic power when they walk into a public place. Narcissists would be very drawn to that idea. I'm gorgeous, but with my gorgeous spouse by my side, we're that much more exponentially powerful.
But, you know, it occurs to me, Steph, with the celebrity stuff that, I mean, most movie star narcissists would never want to admit to that, right?
Oh, of course not.
Right.
'Cause you want to seem approachable and likable.
Right.
Or and there's some that want to be at arm's length from the public and seem a little bit more mysterious. But Sandra Bullock wants to be, you know, like the girl next door. She would never want to be seen as a narcissist.
Movie stars, for as narcissistic as they might be,
you don't want any of that showing.
A quick comment off the Daily Circuit page.
On a lower level of narcissism, Rachel says, for me, there is no better example of narcissism than the explosive popularity of selfies. Do people really think that their face is oh so pretty that it must be included in every photo that they take?
Yeah.
Another note to selfie addicts. Nobody cares what you're eating, let alone what it looks like. So stop taking pictures of what appears to be random platefuls of food. Thanks.
Jeff,
from Rachel.
We could probably do a whole nother hour on social media, but give us one quick thought on that, if you will.
The one quick thought, and you might be surprised at this thought, is that in my book, I kind of let social media off the hook.
Yeah, you do.
There may be more than a billion people on Facebook and close to 100 million on Twitter now. But the fact is, the rise in the scores of the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, which is the standard test for measuring narcissism, that uptick began in 1979, and it had reached full flower 25 years later in 2004. And in 2004, remember, Facebook was still a product of Mark Zuckerberg's dorm room. It was more, the narcissistic explosion in America has been more a sort of unintended consequence of the self-esteem movement, which was a very, very important movement, and a whole lot of people who otherwise would have been marginalized for life have been have benefited by it. But that plus great inflation has also, you know, led a lot of people to come to believe that they sort of came from the womb factory loaded for excellence instead of, you know, having to learn and earn that. Not to say social media doesn't play a role, but when the analogy I use is it's a little bit like what an open bar is to a drunk or a cheesecake buffet is to a glutton. It's just an easier way of getting the substance you were going to be abusing anyway. So we're getting a lot drunker on our narcissism with the help of social media. But, you know, we were already a pretty drunk country to begin with.
Jeff, what a pleasure. Book is great. Always talking to you is wonderful. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Listen to how we're closing the show, won't you?